I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. The National Teachers Union says it's not enough for young people to be indoctrinated in college. It should happen much earlier, and that's what they're down in Portland, Oregon, plotting right now. Plus, the key evidence a Republican ballot observer's attorney will not be allowed to present at trial as opening arguments begin today. And a local council member arrested after a second nude protest. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com, and just click on the banner that says support the show. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. I do want to talk about what's been happening in Portland, Oregon. You're like, what story? Because there's so much happening in Portland. No, not the Antifa riots that have been going on for a month, but it's kind of similar. I imagine it's a pool of the same people, the National Education Association meeting. And really what it shows, I mean, it's clear as day that their goal first and foremost is not to educate your children, it's to indoctrinate your children. Not every teacher is like that, but when the prevailing message from the nation's largest teachers union is about politics, anti-Trump, all of that, then you have to really be concerned that that is pervasive throughout our entire public education system. First, I have two updates for you. The Tim Hazlow case obviously is getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of interest around it. And since opening arguments begin today, I want to make sure that we keep you guys updated on what's going on. Here's the video. Again, I'm just going to remind everyone, reset. Tim Hazlow is the Island County Republican ballot observer who in 2024 was doing his duty, but he was doing his duty without a mask. And so police were sent there to take him out. He was cited for disorderly conduct, but then a highly, highly politically motivated county prosecutor decided that it was enough to charge Tim Hazlow with a felony for an RCW that has to do with unlawful entry into an election facility, which doesn't apply in this case because he didn't unlawfully enter. He literally signed in to be a ballot observer and then was asked to leave. Jury selection was yesterday. Opening arguments began this morning at 9 a.m. So there are a couple key pieces of evidence, according to Tim Hazlow and his defense team, that they've been told through pretrial motions and wheeling and dealing that they are not allowed to bring up in his defense. Chance would have it that they're the two things on the show yesterday I said were the best pieces of evidence for Tim Hazlow to be acquitted of all of this. What were they? Number one, the many, many unhinged social media posts from the prosecutor on the case, Greg Banks, the elected prosecutor on the case, where he's calling, you know, comparing Trump supporters to the KKK, calling them racist bullies, wishing death on people who don't wear a mask, kind of relevant to this case, right? Saying we need to cleanse society of the diseased thinking of mega Trump supporters. I mean, in any world in stretch that is directly relevant to this case being charged as a felony and to the elected prosecutor making the rare step of prosecuting the case himself, jury's not going to be able to see him. That's crazy to me, right? I mean, to me, I would have, if the judge allowed me, I would literally call the prosecutor up to the stand and have him explain these posts. And you would have people on that jury be like, wow, this guy's got a vendetta against Trump supporters and people who don't wear masks. He probably shouldn't be prosecuting this case. Probably should have recused himself. Tim Hazlow's defense team says they can't use that. The other thing they can't use, which is stunning to me, because to me it's the get out of jail free card, so to speak, is that Tim Hazlow wasn't the only one in there who wasn't masked up. Como News went to shoot video and saw this old man actually counting ballots without a mask on, with no good excuse for it. And then, of course, we know the responding officers also weren't wearing masks. Now, I do believe they're able to show the body camera footage, so the jurors will be able to see, if they kind of think about it that way, that the responding officers don't have masks on. But as for the old man who's in that very room, and to me that's very relevant, is if you think that not wearing a mask was serious enough where you had to call the police to get Tim Hazlow removed as a ballot observer, gee, why didn't the old man get removed as well? That would be, I said on a show yesterday, that would be Exhibit A. But Tim Hazlow's defense team says they can't bring up the old man who wasn't wearing a mask the very next day after this happened. Isn't that crazy? I just don't even know how this case exists. A felony. Oh my God. To me, their greatest argument that remains is that the RCW that Tim Hazlow has been charged under was never intended for this kind of purpose. That it's being manipulated to fit a malicious prosecution. And I think that the defense team in their opening arguments, I mean, I'm not there for them today. It's happening over in Coopville, or I would have gone if it weren't a 2.5 hour drive and I had to be here for the show. To me, it's that, hey, we absolutely should have this RCW on the books. Someone who breaks into unlawful entry or barges into an election facility, especially while ballots are being counted, Lord knows what they could do. They could steal ballots. They could alter ballots. They could disrupt the election and counting. 100%, that should be a felony. That's not this. The RCW doesn't apply. It doesn't make any sense. Tim Hazlow didn't barge in. He didn't break in. He didn't unlawfully enter. He walked in the front door. He signed in as a ballot observer. And then he went to peacefully sit there and observe ballots being counted. So this RCW doesn't apply at all. So that's really the only argument, I think it's a strong argument still, that they have to make to the jury is, you know, what is this charge? This makes no sense. This case has been overcharged. He also faces a trespassing charge. So I guess if the jury decides he didn't leave fast enough, maybe they could convict him of trespassing. So I had to update you guys, because that's just nuts. Can't use the two best pieces of evidence. Wild stuff. It's getting a lot of national attention right now, as it should. Second update I want to give to you. Wow, it's interesting what a little public shaming will do, isn't it? So on the show yesterday, we talked about how Doge Washington pointed out, which is just a citizen volunteer, pointed out that the mechanism, the state website that he'd been using to track and reveal spending, you know, misspent, overspent money, just dumb things that your money is being spent on at the state level. He had pointed out that it hadn't been updated since March of this year, which it had been being updated monthly. And at the time when they stopped updating it, Doge Washington was putting out all sorts of crazy stuff about what your tax money was being spent on, just digging into the data. And there were a lot of even national stories about things like the male J.O. Club that was being hosted at a art space, in an art space that got public funding. So all of a sudden, this tool is being used very publicly to do what the tool was intended to do, which is hold the government accountable for spending and be transparent. And then all of a sudden, they stop updating it, and they didn't update it for April, May, June. What's going on? And so we came out and we did a story on it yesterday. And what did I say? I started the story and I said, now there could be an innocent explanation for this. Who knows? I don't know. Let's reach out. And we had reached out to him. We just hadn't heard back yet. And I also know that a couple state representatives, including State Representative Chris Corey, a Republican, when he saw this, he personally reached out in his legislative capacity to get to the bottom of it. So here's what we heard back from the Legislative Evaluation and Accountability Program, which runs this tool. The spending report is now updated through May. Well, howdy doody. Great. Data is usually updated toward the end of the current month for the previous month. This was an atypical delay due to staff leave and workload. We apologize for the delay. June data should be available at the end of this month. So, do I buy that? I don't know. Maybe. And yes, indeed, we went to the website and it does now have data for April and May. They say June is going to come soon. So that's a regular timeline for June. But it seems like they were able to update it awful quick, eh? It's like the timing. Were you going to update it anyway the day after everybody exposed that the tool was no longer being used? So I don't know. Highly suspicious. I think they probably would have taken a little more time to update it had there not been a lot of pressure on them to do so. Just crazy. All right, I want to talk about education today. We already know that in Washington State, there's quite a bit of left-wing ideology amongst the teachers union here. I mean, they advocate for all sorts of insane things. They push political and social issues in schools. They still think it's perfectly appropriate for boys to compete against girls, and they'll call anyone who doesn't agree with that a transphobe. I mean, they're highly, highly ideological, but it's not just the Washington Education Association. this that sentiment and that ideology has proliferated through the National Education Association as well. And look, you know, I don't think it's a particular surprise at this point that any union, but a teachers union leans to the left, right? But you have to understand the NEA members come from all over the country in states that are not as far left as Washington State. But what I really got the sense of, the NEA had its annual conference and it was happening in Portland. What you really get the sense of in watching it is there is no room for dissent. If you're one of these great teachers that I do believe exist, like you're either not at these conferences because they're insane, or you're at the conferences, but you're keeping your mouth shut because they're insane. And if you don't keep your mouth shut, you'll be bullied and vilified and labeled and all of these things, which the end result is now we have this web of teachers across the country who go to these conferences, talk about their agenda for the coming year. It's highly, highly ideological, far left, I mean, socialist, really, in a lot of ways. And then nobody challenges them for whatever reason. And that just becomes what proliferates throughout public schools in the country. It's wild stuff. We touched on a little bit of it during the show yesterday. If you missed it, they adopted these two new policies where they pledged to defend democracy against Trump's embrace of fascism by using the term fascism in NEA materials to correctly characterize Donald Trump's program and actions. So now they're going to actually use the phrase fascist when referring to Donald Trump, because they say that's the accurate way to refer to what Donald Trump is doing. So that's crazy. And then they say they're going to support students' rights to organize against ICE raids and deportations, will protect students' rights to free speech and defend their right to dissent and organize against Trump's policies, including attacks against LGBTQ students and against racism. So we'll defend students' rights to organize only if it's against policies we disagree with. So your students can be activists and can walk out of school and protest, and they'll support that as long as, of course, they're protesting the right things. So we talked about that on the show yesterday, but I want to dive a little bit deeper into what happened at this NEA conference and I think what tells us about the state of public education, in case you had any doubt. So let's just start first and foremost with their teacher of the year, which I think tells you a lot. Her name is Ashley Crossan from Pennsylvania, proud union member, English teacher, 2025 National Teacher of the Year.
I started paying attention once I realized how deeply political our profession had always been. I knew I could no longer stay on the sidelines. So I got involved, I found my people, and my people helped me find my voice.
It's deeply political, so that's why I'm getting involved. Not to better the education of students, not to better the academic outcomes, but because this is a political profession and I need to use my voice to political ends. That's the teacher of the year. Great. All right, so let's hear a little bit. I want to get to a local angle on this in just a second, but there was also this kind of, I don't know, panel type thing. And this just shows you like how radical these teachers are. So this is a teacher named Tina who showed up at the NEA conference, basically saying it's not enough to wait for kids to go to college to be radicalized, which they're just acknowledging that that's also happening. We've got to start the radicalization sooner.
I'm Tina. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, lifetime member of the Teaching Assistants Association, which is an AFT. I'm also a lead steward in Madison Teachers Incorporated, because I left higher education and work in a high school now. So everyone who raised your hand and said that you got radicalized in college, imagine if you got radicalized 4 years earlier. Okay?
Woo! Imagine if you got radicalized 4 years earlier, how much crazier you'd be now as an adult. Oh my God, then everybody woo in the background, just wild. Okay, a couple cuts I wanna play from the head, Kim Anderson, who's the head of the NEA. And this whole speech, and again, so you could argue, you know, there's a lot of good teachers out there who aren't politically far to the left. But when you have the head of the NEA, when you have the NEA voting on new policies like calling Trump a fascist and supporting students who want to protest against Donald Trump and immigration raids, you have unhinged stuff like that guy up there with his keffiyeh on wooing at, yeah, we need to indoctrinate kids 4 years earlier. When you have the teacher of the year being celebrated for her commitment to politicizing the job. And then, of course, the head of the NEA, who is absolutely obsessed with Donald Trump, of course, had to bring up Project 2025.
Project 2025 told us this administration would flood the zone with countless rollbacks of policies that are designed to make us safer, healthier, more prosperous, and more free as a people. They want to spread the pro-democracy coalition wide and thin, dividing us up into narrow factions, assuming that we'll only fight to protect the interests that are closest to us.
Which you will.
Spreading us too wide and too thin to mount a collective defense. That's their theory. Chaos theory is designed to weaken opposition to the regime in power.
Good God. No, it's that they're doing so many things because there's so much dumb stuff happening in the country. And the federal government's trying to tackle all of it. They're trying to fix the immigration system. They're trying to get DEI out of our schools and out of our government. They're trying to stop boys from competing against girls in high schools and in college. They got so much stuff to do because y'all were so unhinged for the last really 8 years plus that they've got to spread themselves thin to cover it all. And this whole idea that they think we'll only fight for the things that impact us, that's all you're going to fight for. You're only fighting for people who agree with your ideology, for the far left. You're not fighting for the parents and families and children who go to your school who support some of the policies of Donald Trump, who maybe, you know, they're struggling financially because their parent can't go to get a good job because they live in an area of the country where there's so much illegal immigrant labor. I mean, you're not fighting for all of your kids. You're fighting for the kids that align with your ideology. It's very, very clear. She also talked about how cruel Donald Trump is.
Cruelty. How many of you are working with students who fear that their parents will be snatched up off the street? Raise your hand. How many of you have students who don't have enough to eat at home? Yeah. Well, delegates, this big, bad, disgusting bill that passed the House 2 days ago pours more money into ICE and strips money out of food assistance programs, ripping children away from their parents, letting kids go hungry. This is beyond cruel. It is immoral.
Good God. So cruel and immoral. So that's the head of the NEA speaking to a room full of teachers that are then going to go do what with that information? After they've been spun up into a frenzy about Donald Trump. He's evil. He's cruel. They're going to go back and they're going to teach their kids that. Not their kids, your kids. They're going to talk about Donald Trump and how evil and cruel he is. And they're going to encourage their kids to organize and to protest. The NEA bylaws now say we support in every way students who want to protest against fascist Donald Trump. All their materials are going to call him a fascist because they say that that's the accurate description of what he's doing. So now teachers are going to say, well, it's perfectly fine to call Donald Trump a fascist. And you know what happens from there. We just had the shooting in Texas where they have materials saying fight fascism. And they showed up with rifles and body armor to shoot Border Patrol agents. I mean, the indoctrination that has led to these violent tendencies of the far left in our country. Those people, you look at the 10 people who face federal charges now for the shooting in Texas, they're young. Most of them look like they're in their 20s. They're fresh out of high school. And these are the kinds of people who are indoctrinating them in those ideologies. And making them believe, starting at a young age, that they're fighting fascism and everything. It's not just Donald Trump. Everything conservative, everything Republican, it's all hateful fascism. They're bigots, they're racist, they're transphobes. And then we send these young people out into the world after 4 years of that. And what do we expect? And that they think they're victims and everything's owed to them. God forbid they're not white. Then they'll leave thinking, well, I'm never going to get ahead. It's wild stuff, you guys. I don't know how we turn it around at this point. I mean, I definitely support parents pulling their kids out of public schools, but I know it's not feasible. And then you got Bob Ferguson, the governor, who talks about how wonderful our public education system is and how boys should compete against girls and all this stuff. He's sending his kids to an elite private school. So he has school choice because he has the money to have school choice. Well, he's forcing you to keep your kids in the indoctrination camps that they've created. Man, it's absolutely crazy. And there were, of course, local educators, some of the worst of the worst, that we've highlighted on this show, who were down at the NEA meeting, including DJ Brimer, who's the president of the Tumwater Education Association, the Tumwater Teachers Union, which, of course, we have talked a lot about the insanity that is happening in Tumwater. But you take one look at his social media and you see exactly the lessons being taught at the NEA and how that fits into now what he preaches as the head of the teachers union for the Tumwater School District. You might recall we featured him on our show previously because he put up a post that seemed to be in direct response to an interview we did on this show with a female athlete, Frances Stout, who sat out her final game of the year because she was being forced to play against a biological boy. And so then he takes to his social media and makes some vague statement about, you know, hating trans people, basically, which very clearly was an attack on a female student who had just very publicly stood up for him, for herself. And these are the kind of people. And then they go to the NEA and they're surrounded by people just like them from across the country, teachers who encourage them that this is right, this is moral, this is just. We have to, as teachers, believe this stuff, fight against Trump. We have to help students organize against Donald Trump. I'm really worried about this generation coming up. I think there's a big split. I think you have some in this younger generation who are being radicalized in a good way. Radicalized in the sense that they've grown up, especially young white kids, frankly, I'm just going to say it, a lot of young white men, cisgender, straight white men who've been basically painted as the enemy for their entire teenage lives. Oh, you have white privilege, you have cisgender privilege, you're a white male, you don't know anything about what it means to struggle, you're the enemy, blah, blah, blah. So they're like, had enough. And they're just like, okay, now I absolutely love Donald Trump and Republicans and conservatism and traditional values, and I'm going all in on that. And then you've got this other group of people who have been told you're the victim, the world is out to get you, you're special, special because of your gender identity, you're a special little prince or princess, we're going to handle you with kid gloves, everything should be given to you. And then they go out into the world. And you got those two factions of young people, and we think this country is going to become less divided? Holy smokes, you ain't seen nothing yet. And the people to blame are unhinged, ideologically driven adults doing this to kids, sending them off into the world with that, either with a grudge, feeling like I've been beaten down because of the color of my skin and because I'm cisgender or whatever it is, or going out into the world thinking they're owed every single thing, and anyone who says anything against them or doesn't support them 100% and give them not equality but special treatment is an enemy. Just wild. Teachers, man. I'm sorry. And I know there's so many good teachers. I don't ever want to come across, like, I have so many good memories of teachers. Kathy Martin is a teacher that comes to mind, who is just such an important person in my life growing up. And I could name Mr. Burnside. I could name a bunch of teachers, Mr. Marcourt. And you remember these great teachers in your life, and I think every student has them, and I think every school has them, even in crazy places like Seattle and Portland and Tumwater and Olympia. But man, more and more, I never remember any of this in school. And I'm really not that old. I mean, I graduated high school in 2006. It was like 20 years ago. None of this stuff. I mentioned my teacher, Mr. Marcourt. He was literally a state lawmaker in Minnesota. And he never brought his personal politics into the classroom. He made a point not to because you just didn't do that. You're there to teach kids. And they've lost track of that. They think their job is to politicize their classrooms. and to teach these young kids the right way of thinking and living. It's just, it's disappointing. I feel bad for the good teachers who are stuck in bad school districts in a state like Washington. Wild. All right, we got a double dose of unbelievable coming up next. Sometimes I think about going to get punching bag classes. I need to do that. Because or else I'm really close to punching a human being in the face. Not any of you guys, but Antifa for sure.
Right.
I just need to get the
kickboxing class, kickboxing. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Get some frustration out on what's happening. Okay. All right. So we'll have a double dose of unbelievable coming up next. And then we have a great lengthy interview with a Democratic state lawmaker who's trying to figure out what the hell is going on with the state taking the contract away from a facility that cares for drug addicted babies. So Representative Mari Levitt is going to be joining us to go over that from the Democratic perspective. First, if your retirement portfolio was a sports team, how did it perform in the first half of 2025? We're halfway through the year. So is your financial advisor making any halftime adjustments? Do you not even know? Do you not even know what's going on? Because that might not be great. I mean, there's just being passive and sort of letting it all just carry on. And I know part of retirement planning is just letting it sit and not looking at it in times of economic turmoil, but certainly with everything going on, is your financial advisor adjusting and checking in? Bulwark's halftime webinar that they're having on July 24th is going to be about halftime in 2025, not a rah-rah speech. It's going to be a straight-up X's and O's discussion on global unrest, how it's affecting the market, tariffs, etc. They'll also give a perspective on the outlook for the second half of 2025, plus a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible, which is what we all care about at the end of the day. So hear directly from Zach Abraham as he shares insights in this free halftime webinar. Thursday, July 24th, register now, knowyourriskpodcast.com. And if you can't make the webinar, at least get a second opinion. It is totally free. Schedule your Know Your Risk portfolio review at knowyourriskpodcast.com. All right, let's do it. Double dose of unbelievable. All right, as you know, the media is failing. You know, as soon as I left, it was just downhill from there. Let's be honest. No, but seriously, there's obviously a bias issue. There's two, I think, issues happening here where you see the decline in ratings for local TV stations, a decline in revenue and staffing and layoffs for newspapers. So I think two things are happening kind of on the same track. One, they're not keeping up often with the way that Americans are consuming media. So you have all these competing sources where people can get media, you know, get news in an instant in a million different ways. And some of these legacy outlets, whether they're newspapers or TV stations, just haven't really done a good job of keeping up with that. I mean, that was definitely an issue while I was there, them not sort of keeping up with trends on social media and delivering news in different ways. So that's happening. A lot of competition out on the market. And then they're hopelessly biased. And I mean, come on, even in a state like Washington, I mean, you're looking at least 35, maybe 40% of people who lean right and don't want to just be fed day after day Democratic talking points. So just like that, boop, you're cutting off half your audience and you're supposed to be, I mean, us, you know, we obviously cater to a certain audience and that's fine, but we're not pretending to be an unbiased news source. So a lot of that is happening. And so you have either layoffs or reporters just getting paid less. And I'll be honest, some of the salaries these days for reporters, even in a city as big as Seattle, they're not great. So the Pacific Northwest Newspaper Guild, which represents several journalists for several publications, but also for the Everett Herald, they are now coming out and demanding higher wages. But it's not just that. They want you, the reader, to cancel your subscriptions if they don't get higher wages. This is really something else. So they put out a press release. Everett Herald journalists call for community support in battle against low wages and story quotas. They say Carpenter Media won't budge on $20.50 an hour wages with raises tied to 2 to 3 story a day quotas as it decimates local journalism in the Pacific Northwest. Affected journalists are available for news interviews. The Everett Herald news staff are asking subscribers to support their contract fight against Carpenter Media Group. The News Guild is calling on Everett Herald subscribers to email the publisher and the regional manager saying they are willing to cancel their subscriptions if they fail to give journalists the pay and working conditions they deserve. Gee, okay. Really weird tactic there, because if you're not getting paid enough, what will happen if a bunch of people cancel their paid subscriptions? Gee, something tells me that won't free up additional revenue to give you a raise. So it's just this really backwards. So what, you want to put them out of business if you don't get a raise? Newsflash, then you'll be out of a job. I also have to say, though, I don't feel bad for them. I mean, $20 an hour for a newspaper job is quite low, I guess, historically. I mean, $20 an hour is like basically the state minimum wage at this point. So, I mean, but newspaper reporters have never made an awful lot of money. And then they're upset about you have to have these 2 to 3 story a day quotas. Okay, first and foremost, then get a different job. If it's really that bad where you have to, oh my gosh, we have to have story quotas and we get $20 an hour, you have free will. Go somewhere else. Do something else. A lot of people leave media and go into PR jobs, for instance, in the corporate world because it just doesn't pay enough money. That's been happening for years. You see your favorite person disappear from TV and then they pop up as a PR flacky for some corporation making 3 times the money that they were making before. So you have free will. And I get it that journalism is a career that a lot of people enjoy and they want to keep doing it. But if they're not paying you enough money, then you got to do something else, right? So I just don't understand that. But here's the thing is like, man, imagine if rather than threatening the company and saying, if you don't pay us this much money, we're going to have subscribers cancel their subscriptions, right? Here's an idea. Like, try to do a better job. Try to do some unbiased reporting. Try to expand your subscriber base to, dare I say, conservatives and people in the middle who are tired of the Everett Herald's consistent Democratic talking points. I mean, at this point, they are stenographers for the Democratic Party, and you are dramatically limiting your subscriber base. So it's like you see this repeatedly where these news stations and outlets that are failing won't do the single most important fundamental thing to try to get back on track. They will not be critical of themselves and their performance. They refuse to be introspective. It's all about the external forces that are hurting their industry. Nothing about them. They won't admit fault. They won't admit mistake. They won't admit shortcomings. They won't say, hey, what could we do better to be more profitable? How can we change to keep up with what people want and expect? Nope. All of these other things. Oh, you know, let's blame Donald Trump because he attacks the news media. Oh, gosh, what else can we blame? What else can we blame? You know, can we get tax breaks? They want tax breaks from the government. All these different things, and they won't just say, hey, maybe it's us. Maybe it's us. Maybe we need to keep up with the times. Maybe we need to actually deliver unbiased news to people because that seemed to work in the past. And the more bias and bias that we've got, the fewer subscribers that we've got. So just a thought, but also to those reporters, probably not a good idea to encourage people to cancel their subscriptions if you don't get a raise, because that will guarantee that you don't get a raise. All right. Oh, my gosh. Gird your loins. Gird your loins. Close your eyes for our next segment of Unbelievable. And I really do mean gird your loins. So in March of this year, there was a story about a Stevenson, Washington city council member named Lucy Losser. And Lucy was in the news because Lucy decided to sit topless on a park bench to make a political statement. Here's that video.
Unfortunately, I need you to cover yourself up or it's considered indecent exposure.
That's not true.
Why?
Nudity as a form of protest is allowed under First Amendment.
But you cannot expose yourself like that.
Topless?
I know you're expressing your First Amendment, but you cannot expose yourself. And if anyone calls in and is offended by it, you need to cover yourself. Do you understand?
I don't understand why you're trying to violate the law.
really something else. So that happened March 31st. And then all of this other information came about. If you haven't figured it out, Lucy's a dude, okay? In case it wasn't clear. Lucy is a man who identifies as a woman and is a member of the Stevenson City Council. And at the time, Annie Ngo, who's an independent journalist, exposed all these other nude pictures that this council member would post online. Just straight up, full frontal nudity, back nudity. Their social media, armed and queer, transsexual menace, calling Republicans Nazis, taking a shower at a campground, 30-year-old female, around 280 pounds, 6'3". Well, okay, I think you're lying about two things there. Weighing your gender. Not that I haven't lied about my weight before, so you do you. But this is a city council member. I mean, this is absolutely, clearly is a perversion, right? Clearly that's a perversion. And so you want to say that, like, you're sitting on a park bench nude from the waist up, which we'll talk more about because I realize, like, if it's a man, is that really public indecency? So we'll talk about that. But, like, a lot of they started a recall effort against this council member over it and over some of these other just bizarre online posts. Well, apparently Lucy hasn't gotten enough attention because on July 4th of all days, Lucy was at it again. This is from Uplift Local. Stevenson City Council member arrested after a second shirtless protest. Allow me to read some details. Stevenson City Council member Lucy Lossier faces indecent exposure charges after a bare-breasted protest outside the Skamania County Courthouse on July 4th. A sergeant and two deputies, and minutes later, the sheriff himself responded to a... responded to a handful of calls to law enforcement about Lossier's nudity. Sergeant R. Taylor asked Lossier to put her, the news article calls it her, calls him her, to put her top back on to avoid a citation for indecent exposure. When she refused, she was handcuffed and escorted to a law enforcement vehicle, then a holding cell. A friend posted $500 bail, allowing Lossier to go free after about an hour. Quote, I'm demonstrating for trans people's right to be treated with respect and dignity and not be sexualized, Lossier said. I'm protesting the president calling me a man, an anti-American and unworthy of service to my country and all sorts of other stuff. So let me just get this straight quick. It says, during the protest, Lossier carried a cardboard sign that said, stop sexualizing trans people. She had painted one arm red, put black tape over her mouth and nipples, and wrote, woman, life, freedom, on her chest. Okay, so you're topless, holding a sign that says, my body is not obscene, stop sexualizing trans people. While you're online posting all sorts of images of yourself, fully nude, buck naked. Showering in public showers. If you're not trying to sexualize yourself, then what are you doing? It just shows you this is really an unhinged reality. And I also have to say, to those brave members of law enforcement, I will personally pay for your therapy if you need it. And also, if you went blind over this ordeal, I'll pay for your eye surgeries to try to restore your vision. So just want to extend that to the Skamania County Sheriff's deputies and sheriff who were exposed to this. But there's also something we have to discuss here. I actually don't believe that's public indecency. Because those aren't breasts.
Well, but they've been medically altered to look like breasts.
So we've seen a picture. That's true. So this is a good debate. So we saw a picture that we didn't air of the unblurred frontal, okay? And if you covered the face and the other bottom part, they looked like breasts, okay? So I don't know if it's been a surgical enhancement or if it's been a medical sort of hormonal enhancement. I don't know. But if Lucy insists that Lucy is a woman, then I guess Lucy can't go into court and argue these are male pecs, and so you wouldn't, males can have their shirt off. So either Lucy has to stick to that or admit that, no, I'm a biological man, and so these aren't breasts at all, which would put Lucy in a pretty tough position. But also for me, if I'm saying Lucy's a man, then can I really argue that it's indecent exposure? I don't know. It's a pickle. I'm in a conundrum. I mean, it looks like breasts, right? They look like breasts.
Very much.
Very much so. And I won't make you see
not,
it.
Not, you know, not Sports Illustrated or Playboy worthy.
Right.
For sure.
None. Whose are, right? Right?
Whose are, right?
Mine aren't, you know? But it just shows, like, it's this very odd sort of conundrum. Mm-hmm. I just feel bad for the Skamania County Sheriff's Office. That's really why I wanted to do the story today. And Lucy, the council member, just insists on nudity. Insists. Absolutely. And what do they call it? Autogonophilia? I think this is a case of autogonophilia.
Oh, 100%.
This is about
Exhibit
men
A.
who identify and try to present mm-hmm. as women for some sort of sexual gratification. It has all the hallmarks on it, of it, given all the nude pictures online. Anyway, sorry you guys had to see that. I truly, truly am. All right, we've got a lengthy interview with a state Democratic lawmaker coming up next, who's trying to save the pediatric interim care center. First, I have told you guys, take the First Mark challenge. Do not delay. Do not wait another day. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. We all need insurance, so why not make sure you have the best insurance at the best price, and you're only paying for insurance that you need, and then not even doing it yourself, having someone else do it for you for free. Total no-brainer. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. We hear from Undivided viewers and listeners all the time who are now members of the First Mark family, who say they save thousands of dollars a year just with that one phone call. Jacob says, we recently changed our insurance over to your awesome sponsors at First Mark. They saved us $600 plus on our home and around $2,000 a year for our family's cars. They were honest and easy to work with. My wife even knew our agent's mother from the past. I love it, because First Mark is a family after all. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. They always have your best interests in mind. Okay, we are going to keep this story in the news because it is so critical. It's so common sense. It is insane that the state of Washington is putting drug addicts ahead of the safety of babies and children, but that's what's happening. So we've done a few stories now on the decision from the state of Washington to defund and then pull the contract of the Pediatric Interim Care Center. This is a facility in Kent that's been around for decades that takes care of babies who are born drug addicted. And it is a really, I mean, it's just such a wonderful facility, and they make it feel like a home. So it's not like these babies are in this chaotic hospital setting. They each have their own little rooms, and they have somebody there to take care of them and to cradle them and to, you know, just make sure that they feel loved and safe while they're getting the treatment they need. So it's just crazy at a time when we've seen the numbers from DCYF, the numbers of babies being born into addiction is up, the numbers of children under the care of the state of Washington who die after exposure with drugs or who almost die after exposure with drugs, way up, way up. This is shaping up to be a very sad year on that front. And then Democrats turn around. Bob Ferguson vetoes $100,000, a measly $100,000 in funding to this facility. And then the Department of Children, Youth and Families pulls the contract. So on Sunday's show, we had Representative Michelle Caldeer on two Sundays ago, I think it was. We had a guest this Sunday talk about it as well, about they're trying to get to the bottom of why the state of Washington did this. Why did Democrats want to defund this thing? So we've heard a lot from Republicans, haven't heard a lot from Democrats, except for State Representative Maury Leavitt, who, as we discussed on the show, she went on social media, tagged Bob Ferguson, said she was calling on him to pause the decision to end the PIC contract and extend it a year to spend the time with intention to assess the system need, options available, and how best to move forward, nothing to lose, and only babies to care for to survive and thrive. So she became the first elected Democrat in Olympia to say, hey, we need to keep PIC open, at least for now, while we give this a thorough review and not just close this facility at a time of great need that's been operating for years and years and years. So Representative Maury Leavitt, again, a Democrat, was nice enough to join us today to talk about what the hell is going on. Representative, welcome back to Undivided.
Thanks, Brandy, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you speaking up about PIC, and, you know, it should be a a political nonpartisan issue. Have you been able to ascertain any further details about why they decided to not only defund it, but pull the license?
Yeah, I have. And I had conversations with DCYF before I went on the tour. So I could understand from their perspective what had happened and why, and also to help me be informed to ask questions that I may have while I'm on the tour. And so they provided me some information and I asked those questions. But, you know, from their perspective, what I gather is they view PIC as using a model that was developed in the 1990s and no longer is relevant or considered a best practice compared to the kinds of services that children can get in different care models. They also, you know, talked about the fact that PIC wasn't asking for Medicaid dollars, so we were leaving federal dollars on the table. And I understand. I mean, we never want to leave federal dollars on the table. We always want to get the federal dollars first if we can as a state. But I'm not sure that argument matters because of the private funding that PIC receives. So it's not as if they're solely, relying on public dollars to operate. And then they also just talked about the fact that fewer babies were coming to the facility and were getting referred. And so it may not be as cost efficient because the nature of the contract is 12 months. Sorry, my cat is...
Hey, we always love a good cat debut.
Yes. So because of the nature of the contract, it was 12 months divided, monthly in terms of the revenue that they were receiving, PIC was receiving. And so perhaps not as cost effective. Again, I'm not so sure that argument holds water, but that's the rationale. And the veto came about because DCYF recommended it, knowing that the contract was significantly less. It had gone from about 1.4, 1.5 over a two-year period down to 100,000. And so DCYF was the one, or the entity rather, that recommended the veto because I had a meeting with the governor's office as well to understand from their perspective what happened.
Yeah, and I should correct myself because I said at the beginning the state pulled their license, but they still have a license. They just don't have a contract, so they're not able to get infants. Yeah, a lot of that, I tend to agree with you. You know, the budgetary argument doesn't hold any water for me, and so I wish it had never been brought up by anyone. This idea of the outdated model, I've heard some rumors, and maybe it's just rumors, that they basically don't think that the woman who runs PIC is deferential enough to the mothers in addiction. I mean, do you think by touring it and what you know about PIC that this is a place that has an outdated model or is not a good place for these babies to go?
Yeah, no, quite the contrary. I mean, I do, you know, I think they're from DCYF's perspective, when they talk about the model, it's eat, sleep, and console. And for my touring PIC, and I'm really so grateful that my colleagues did an all-call invitation to visit because I've been wanting to for a little bit. And so what I saw was a place that was low stimulation environment, which I think these children really, really need, these little sweet babies. I saw a place that was clean, that was quiet, that was professional, that had medical grade equipment that I would think you would need. And so I they would say, the ladies who run PIC and as well as the board chair, who also toured with us, that they do provide an eat, sleep, console model. While it may not be precisely as defined by DCYF or perhaps the best practice model that is being proclaimed to be the ideal way for these babies to be treated, it certainly, I think, qualifies as the eat, sleep, console model in the relevancy of taking care of these babies as they need. So again, I think that argument, it doesn't fly. The other thing that DCYF, I think, has shared concerns about is parental access to the babies. And so there is a difference. I mean, hospitals, I think, have a parent has more access. And the argument that DCYF has made is that these families can't sleep in. So they don't have the 24/7 access that perhaps you might have somewhere else. And then also that they've requested PIC to provide those kinds of avenues and access for parents. And while PIC has increased their access, they don't have a sleep-in model. Mm-hmm. But again, PIC has paid for hotel vouchers for nearby hotels for these parents so that they can come anytime within a period of hours, within daytime hours. And again, I think that was a concern of DCYF is access. But I just don't think that necessarily holds water as well. While I understand that's the ideal, we want our families to interact with these babies as much as possible. Not all families or guardians are able to do that. And so allow them to continue to serve the families who aren't equipped to be able to take care of these babies in the way that they really need it.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of doing the reporter's job by saying, here's what I'm being told, here's why it doesn't hold water. And I tend to agree with you. I mean, every kind of excuse that's been put forth, you know, like the Eat, Sleep, Console, the director of PIC has trained other people in that method. And so, as you pointed out, it's a method that they use there, maybe not to the letter of what the state would want. So I guess, what does your gut tell you, Representative, is at the center of this decision, especially at a time when there are more babies in need? There are more babies being born addicted.
Yeah, I think my gut says we need to keep the contract. That's what my gut says. I think my professional knowledge based on the conversations that I've had is I don't think that we know as a state what the needs are. I don't think we've assessed how many beds are available and where these beds are and for our foster families, who are they equipped to take care of these babies in the way that they need it? I don't think we have answers to that, Brandy, and that's been my concern. And I don't think we know what's the cost differential between a baby being treated at PIC, which again has public-private partnership, which are always the best models in my view, to have a little bit of both. And I don't think that we know that answer. And, I have asked for that information. I haven't received it yet. I've asked the governor's office for that information. I don't think they know it. I have another meeting this afternoon with DCYF and the secretary, along with another legislative colleague of mine, and another meeting with the governor's office this Friday. It'll be the second meeting. And so my gut says I think they're digging in and moving on. And I think that's truly unfortunate. I hope that the continued conversations and the more that folks are, legislative colleagues are inquiring, I hope that resonates with folks, but I just don't think it's the right time. If at the end of the year, what I've called for is that we unsever the contract, allow PIC to continue, and at the end of a year, if we assess that their model is perhaps not the best model and there are better things out there and enough beds, great. But we don't know that. And I don't think anybody does in good faith to be able to say that.
Yeah. And here's the maybe difficult question politically, although I don't think you've shied away from, you're on our show, right? I'm sure that your fellow Democratic colleagues will love that. Do you trust DCYF to be making decisions with the best interests of these vulnerable kids in mind?
I think there are staff at DCYF who do have the best interests of children in mind. I do. We have a new secretary. I called on the removal of the last secretary. I made that public, and that was mainly related to juvenile justice issues and Greenhill. But I do trust that this new secretary and Secretary Sin wants to do the right thing, and ensuring that she's surrounding herself with folks who aren't... I call it bureaucratic lens. You get entrenched as employees and think you know best, and hubris can get in the way of serving the public in the way that they deserve. And so I'm hoping that is not the case in this venture for PIC, that they step back and realize perhaps we don't have all the answers, perhaps we aren't making the right decision, and do some reflection to recognize that we need this facility because to my knowledge, we don't have a lot of facilities like PIC who can give the most incredible intensive care that these babies need. And I had a constituent with a baby who was cared for in PIC, and he told me, Mari, this was a low stimulation barrier for these babies who are going through hell, quote, going through hell. because of how they were born, and it's a form of torture for them not to have the care in the way in which they need it, and to close down PIC, in his view, is also a mistake. And so, you know, I trust my constituent who cared for a baby that was after PIC, and so I trust his information as well. And so I do think DCYF wants to do the right thing, but I think that there are some folks who are embedded and have wanted to make this decision, I suspect, for a while, and perhaps saw an opportunity to do so and move on. And I think it was short-sighted, and I think it's a mistake. And I shared that I thought it was a mistake to the governor's office as well, and will continue to say that.
Yeah, and I know, and maybe it's a better way to ask the question. I mean, I know you've been critical of some aspects or results, I guess, of the Keeping Families Together Act. We've seen the latest numbers from DCYF that this year we could have maybe more than three times the amount of children under the care or watchful eye of the state that could die or have near-death experiences from some sort of interaction with drugs in the home, which is just awful. It's not the outcome anyone wanted when it came to the Keeping Families Together Act. So I guess, do you think DCYF is prioritizing drug-addicted parents over the well-being of children?
That's a good question. I think they're prioritizing finding ways to keep families together in all ways that they can. But I think our current laws, you know, I introduced House Bill 1159, which is endangerment, opiates, endangerment of a crime, to enhance that, the current statute, which currently is a misdemeanor. Methamphetamine is a felony, and it's on the books, but we want to expand that. And part of the reason for expanding that is if it's a felony, it allows courts to get parents into treatment, and it allows no contact orders, which the courts currently don't have, until such time that a parent gets the treatment that we know and we want them to receive, and to keep those children safe. You know, there's a baby who was killed in Pierce County not that long ago, and speaking to the prosecutor, and she talked about how the investigator, this little sippy cup was just covered. It was so contaminated in a way that they hadn't seen since the meth days. And so, you know, you bring this up, and I've raised it as well. And what DCYF points out is because I've said, look, our rates are increasing of babies being either born addicted or being exposed to drugs that will kill them. I mean, babies taking fentanyl is a lot different than an adult, and even adults die pretty quickly with the right, you know, with the right amount. And so what they say is that you can't conflate the two. They're two distinct issues, and PIC does not take care of those babies who are older, who have been impacted. PIC takes care of tiny little babies coming out of the hospital, being born addicted, and going through withdrawals. So they're two distinct, very different issues. And so, fair point. Fair point that it wouldn't be taking care of those children, but we still have an obligation to take care of those children. And for me, if you have fentanyl lying around your house, and that's why I introduced House Bill 1159, working with the prosecutors, to me, it's the same thing as having a loaded gun on a coffee table. I mean, if you're not going to leave a loaded gun lying around for a four-year-old to pick up and shoot a sister, right? Because they're going to play with whatever's around them. And to me, leaving fentanyl on a table or in your house when you have children in the vicinity, children pick up things and they put it in their mouth. 12-year-olds pick up things and put it in their mouth. And so there is a liability and an obligation of a parent or a guardian or someone who is living in that home to keep those children safe, and they're not doing that. And so that's why I think we need to change that law. And I'm hoping in the conversation today that we can talk about those things as well, is what do we need to change in our current law to allow our social workers to identify in advance before a child dies. And I just don't think we're doing enough. And those numbers are alarming to me as well.
Yeah. And I will ask you about that next, but then, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Do you believe the Keeping Families Together Act is directly responsible, at least in part, for the rise in deaths of children under the care of DCYF?
I don't know. I mean, I know, I understand your question. And I'm not avoiding the question. I just don't know. I need to see the stats of the how often DCYF was involved in those cases or not involved. and what determinations were made to be able to really correlate the two together. I do think we need to fix the Keeping Washington, Keeping Families Together Act and adjust for the increase and rise in the deaths that we're seeing, or near deaths, near fatalities. I mean, you know, we revived a lot of kids with Narcan, thank goodness, including, you know, one in Pierce County who was a 12-year-old. But again, having access to that and increasing access, you know, we shouldn't be known as the second state in the union of deaths from fentanyl and opiate related things. And that's not how Washington State wants to be known. And that's how we are. And the deaths in Pierce County are no different. And it's very concerning. And so we need to fix something about it. And we need to listen to our social workers who are crying out for a change, and what legislatively that change is yet will be determined, and how that correlates, I don't know, but I'm certainly asking those questions to find out, because if we're contributing to these deaths, then we're culpable as state elected officials, and I don't want to be culpable for a baby's death in my county.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I don't think anybody wants to be culpable. And it's kind of crazy to me that we're even having the conversation about, like, who gets more deference, you know, a parent who's going through addiction, or a baby or a toddler who can't stand up for themselves. You know, it's like, well, obviously, let's make sure the baby or the child is safe. And we want to help both. But it's so weird to me, this push and pull of, like, well, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the interview with Representative Roger Goodman, who's the chair of the Public Safety Committee. He did an interview with King 5 News where he basically said, you know, it was about the, I don't know if it's directly the bill that you introduced, it might have been, but about, oh, you know, we don't want to hold parents accountable for, you know, if their child gets in contact with drugs, because we don't want to punish their addiction. That was stunning to me. I mean, that's a stunning thing. How do you, I guess, when you're saying the Keeping Families Together Act needs to be fixed, is there an appetite based on comments like that among your fellow Democrats to fix it?
Yeah, I hope there is. I mean, I respectfully disagree with my good chair of that committee in on this issue. I think that we have a responsibility to these children. And we want parents to get treatment. And that's why 1159 increases it to a felony, because it allows that no contact order to not allow the parents to have access to that child until such time that they get treatment and it can order treatment. And so I think that we have to change the laws, and we have to recognize that we are placing these children in danger, and we can't continue to do that. And so I think while I understand that, you know, a parent losing a child is the most unimaginable, horrific thing, in particular if you caused it, I mean, the grief and guilt, I would imagine, would be tremendous. And we can't allow it to occur. And that's the problem. I mean, I understand that argument. I don't understand that argument that we can't hold families accountable. And in fact, we just had two parents charged in Pierce County because of their child's death. But the difference is, when I asked the prosecutors, well, you can already charge. You know, I saw the Pierce County prosecutor not that long ago, and I said, I need talking points. I need to understand, if you can already charge and you're charging the parents, why do we need to change the law? You know, if you can do it, you can do it. And she said it's because it's a misdemeanor. There's not a lot of accountability. It's felony allows the no contact order, and it allows the courts to get those families for near deaths and deaths into treatments. And we can't do that without changing the law. So in my view, if we care about our babies and our children, and we want people to get in treatment, which we all do, I mean, all of us, I think the majority of Washingtonians know someone, if they don't have someone in their family who has been addicted in some form, and myself included. And so, not that I was addicted, but certainly have family members who have been. It's tremendous, the journey that they need to go through, but they also can't put children in danger, and that's what we're allowing them to do.
Yeah, and as we've said on this show, you can't keep families together if somebody's dead. That is definitely not keeping families together.
Yeah.
I want to ask you really quickly about a story that's been in the news for a few days. This working group to consider a plan for a safe drug supply. And I think it goes hand in hand with, you know, this direction we're going in this state to sort of normalize substance abuse. So my understanding of it, please correct me if I'm off base on any of it. The working group was created by a bill that was passed by the legislature in 2021 to look into this idea of a safe supply. I think you voted for the overarching bill, which had to do with kind of addressing the decision from the Blake decision and the drug possession statute change. Did you know at the time? I mean, were you aware that this working group was considering a plan to literally like have the state become drug dealers?
Oh, goodness, no. No, the 2021 bill was the Blake decision. That was a bipartisan vote. We needed to do something because I wouldn't say decriminalized, but it lowered the threshold. And so we needed to get back to the threshold of what it should be as a gross misdemeanor. But I had no concept of a working group that was recommended. It's funny you should ask. I just got appointed to the Substance Use Advisory Committee. So it's called CERSAC. And I attended my first meeting. I just got appointed last week and just attended my first meeting a couple days ago. And the chair of the committee started off because there were several new members, including three new legislators, myself included, talking to, and I would say distancing themselves from this work group. The chair talked about the fact that, we just want you to know that there's misinformation in the news. You may have questions about this. This is not a work group associated with our committee. It is a work group that we recommended a work group study the issue. And that's it. That's our exact, association with it. And so I pressed a little bit. I'm like, well, what's true and what's not, and how is it aligned? And do we have jurisdiction over the committee that they recommend to us? Do they recommend to the healthcare authority? Somebody does the contract, therefore somebody has to manage the contract.
Right.
I didn't get quite my answers that I was hoping to get clarity.
Yeah.
But again, I'm a new member, and the first introduction to having that conversation and realized that wasn't the purpose of the meeting. He was just trying to make a point, like, we're not a part of it. We're not a part of it is kind of what I heard.
Well, how can he say they're not a part of it if they recommended that there be a working group to look at?
Well, they recommended
supply.
The work group, I think, and that's it. And that's disbanded. Yeah. So I have asked for a separate meeting to understand the alignment and what the work group, who are they reporting to? Who are they making the recommendations to? Is it state? Is it county? Is it local communities that are making those decisions, or local hospitals? I don't know. I don't know. And so yeah. I need to know in order to understand the correlation to the work group, or to the committee rather, that I just got appointed to. And so I invited my new legislator colleagues who are just newly appointed to join me in that meeting to help us understand exactly how they're aligned, and then also what is being done with those work group recommendations, because I think some of them certainly caused me pause, but I haven't read them all in detail. But for now, I just want to know how it's associated with the committee and associated with the state agency and what they're going to do about it.
Right. I mean, I'm looking at a document.
What they're going to do with the recommendations, not what they're going to do about it. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at a document of the recommendations that has Washington State Healthcare Authority on the top of it in the letterhead. So if they created the, or called for it, they called for it for a reason. They wanted to look into the issue and now want to distance themselves from it. It's kind of weird to me. And I mean, all of the recommendations in it are cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. I mean, the fact that we would in any way supply drugs to people who are in addiction is nuts. In any form or fashion, is that something that you would support, Representative?
Generally, no. I don't think that helps. I have supported methadone clinics. Our local health department had a methadone clinic where people can get treatment. I mean, that's a form of weaning oneself off, but that's regulated through the health department and others. That we've had in Pierce County for a while that has been successful, but I don't support supplies being given, and certainly not regulated controlled substances being given to individuals, even if they are in safe places, to be able to continue to use. I don't think that's the best model in any research that I've seen that suggests that they eventually wean off and become successful and treated with recovery. I look forward to looking at those recommendations, but certainly can't imagine a world in which I would support those.
I would take those recommendations, I would crumple them up, and I would just throw them in the trash. I mean, it's wild stuff. There's a sentence in here where they're talking about, let's do this and then find alternative lawful income sources for people trapped in the illicit distribution economy. They're talking about drug dealers. Like, if we step in as the drug dealers, let's find alternative lawful income sources for the drug dealers we put out of work. It's wild stuff. Well, yeah, Representative,
that's not something I would support in any way, shape, or form.
Well,
yeah.
I do. Well, to be clear, I do support drug dealers finding other jobs, lawful jobs.
Well,
that aren't,
but I'm not
drugs.
Not state subsidized. Correct.
Not state subsidized. Yes. Oh, yes. What a crazy world we're in. Well, Representative, I appreciate your time. Thank you for advocating for not only PIC, but also just children. Like, it's crazy to me that there are so few who are being vocal about this real problem that we have with substance abuse and these innocent kids. And so I just can't thank you enough for being a strong advocate and trying to fix some of the faults in the laws that are on the book. So please keep us updated on the PIC front.
I will.
And we'll see what happens there.
Great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
So that is State Representative Maury Leavitt, a Democrat who wants to figure out, like Republicans do, what the heck is happening with the situation with his facility and the money being taken away and the contract being taken away. It's all screams of politics and ideology. And this agenda of giving deference to drug addicted parents and doing things that don't protect children, which is just wild to me. So I'm glad there's at least one. We got one Democrat in Olympia who's willing to say that out loud and say, hey, we need to do better for these kids. And why would we just like that defund this facility at a time of record need? Makes no sense. We're not letting the story go. We're talking about little babies here, born drug addicted. Should be non-controversial, non-political. So we're not going to let the story go until they at least give the contract back to PIC and then do some actual work and tell us the real reason. That's the other issue here is they came out, oh, it's the budget. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. Oh, it's that. When you have to change your story so much, it's clear you're lying. So if you gave us a reason and stuck to it, then at least we'd have a starting point to work with to understand what happened. But you're not willing to tell the truth, which makes all of us very suspicious. So wild. Appreciate Maury Leavitt's time. All right, coming up next, you know I had to talk about the Jeffrey Epstein thing just a little bit. I know we're going to go long today. Also, Tom Homan coming to Oregon? Pinch me, I can't wait. First, if you're thinking about selling your home, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Super easy, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their free home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. And then reach out to Wes for a free market analysis. Free market analysis where he's going to talk to you about how homes are performing in your area, kind of set your expectations, go over things like timing, how, you know, what price point would we list your house at? What's the strategy here? And then he can talk to you about other offerings that you're not going to get anywhere else, like their Listing Boost concierge service, which just makes sure your home is in tip-top shape to get the most possible value out of it. And the nice thing is Wes comes in, he can manage those projects. He loves doing it. He can manage those projects, cosmetic upgrades, and take all that stress off you. You don't even have to pay for that stuff until closing, which also takes the financial stress. So you don't have to come out of pocket a bunch of money just to update a few things in your home to make sure that you get a good price for it, which is what we all want at the end of the day. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. It just simply is a better way to sell your home. Much, much, much less stressful as well. All right, a couple things in national. Tom Homan says, had enough. He's personally coming to Portland to deal with the Antifa lunatics who have been outside the ICE facility there for a month.
I'm going to head to Portland. I'm going out there. They're not going to bully us or you know, we're going to do the job. We're going to do it in Portland too. But for the mayor of New York City and Chicago, President Trump made it clear 2 weeks ago. We're going to double down and triple down on sanctuary cities. Yeah. Why? Not because they're blue. Because we know there are recent public safety threats to the streets every day. Like Florida, we agree with all the sheriffs in Florida. They're taking our detainers. They're not releasing illegal alien public safety threats. They're calling us. So we can spend less resources in Florida and send them to New York, to Chicago, and to Portland, and L.A. We're going to double down and triple down on sanctuary cities. If we can't arrest a bad guy in the jail, then we'll go to community and we'll find him. Or we'll do more worksite enforcement. We'll find him at the worksite. And when we do these things and we ramp up that enforcement, we're going to find others. Others who aren't a criminal target, but they're in the country illegally, we're going to arrest them too. So what you're going to get, sanctuary cities, is exactly what you don't want. More agents in your communities and more collateral arrest. That's what we're going to do. We're doubling down, tripling down. So for those who say they want to keep ICE out of the city, good luck with that.
Good luck with that. I love Tom Homan. We are trying to, if he does go to Portland, which he says he's going to, effort an interview with him, but I'll drive all the way down there just to shake his hand. I'll take you for a drink, Tom Homan. Pat you on the back. And I agree. I mean, I think when you have this level of pushback from sanctuary communities that are actually leading to more ICE immigration enforcement out in neighborhoods, to me, I mean, flooding the zone is the only way to do it until they're willing to come to the table and say, hey, okay, let's calm down. Let's all be reasonable here. And that means sanctuary jurisdictions understanding and acknowledging maybe it's a reasonable thing to help ICE to get dangerous convicted criminals out of our state and out of our country. So maybe we should be helping them facilitate those arrests at jails and at prisons so it's safer for everyone. Maybe that's the common sense thing to do. And then maybe you'll get the Trump administration to give a little bit and say, okay, you know, maybe we don't need to do as many workforce, worksite enforcement actions. Maybe we don't have to prioritize some of these other things if you're willing to help us with the real violent criminals. And then, you know what? Kumbaya. But somebody's got to come to the table and be reasonable about the situation. All right, Jeffrey Epstein. So Pam Bondi, she's lost MAGA. She's lost MAGA. She says there is no Epstein client list. So they've said, you know, Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. There is no Epstein client list, which is kind of odd because she came out and she was asked on the news, like, hey, are you going to release the Epstein client list? And she said, it's on my desk right now for review. Now, part of me thinks, so I will give credit to Trump supporters that they are not afraid to criticize the president. They were critical of him on Iran. Many of them were. They're critical of this. And, you know, it's not in dispute that Jeffrey Epstein was a sick predator. You know, there's been mainstream stories going back years to his time in Florida and all of that. So there's no dispute that Jeffrey Epstein was a predator of young girls and a purveyor of young girls. I don't think that's in dispute at all. It seems to be like maybe there's a semantic issue here of what do you mean by client list? Like, did they expect that there would literally be a list? Because part of the accusations against him was he was engaged in blackmail against, you know, powerful people where he'd kind of have cameras in rooms, film them having sex with underage girls, and then use that to blackmail them into doing other things for him. So is this a semantic issue? Is it like, no, there wasn't a literal list he was keeping of names? Because to me, like flight logs, people who were visiting Epstein Island, I mean, that's a list in a certain form. You can't tie every single one of them to illicit criminal behavior. But it's all just weird. And now MAGA is losing its mind, thinking that President Donald Trump is in on this grand conspiracy to hide or help or shield whoever might have been involved with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, I don't know if that's true. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll to weigh in on it on Patreon, Locals, and X. I said the Department of Justice says there is no Epstein client list. Do you believe that's the truth? Yes or no? Nicole Thompson.
I believe that they have their own list of names. I believe that they know who's been involved. But like you said, can you use that to prove illegal activity? Probably not. So they'd have to match that with actual proof, right? So having a list of friends of Jeffrey Epstein's,
right, it's not the same. Like Bill Gates.
Right. So I'm sure Trump is on his list of friends. We've already said that, yeah, they ran in the same circle at some point. I mean, I'm sure all of them have friends that are in that circle. Bill Gates, the Clintons, all of these people are in his friend group. Does that mean that they all participated? Oh, some people would say yes, but I would say no, you can't prove
right,
that.
Right, and Trump was already named in Jeffrey Epstein documents, but right, he wasn't accused of any sort of criminal wrongdoing. And the thing is, here's what I don't get. So you say yes, it does exist or no?
I say no.
No, not in like a true, like, not here's a true, list here's we're a hiding list of the for, people. Right? Mm-hmm.
And she said, when she said that she had it on her desk, she was referring to the file.
Right. That's what she's clarifying. I also think there's an element of, before we get to some of your responses, because overwhelmingly 90% of you say you do not believe that the White House when they say that there is no Epstein client list. So there's lot of skepticism among conservatives.
Because I usually defend Mr. Trump. I will say that I didn't love his response when he got very critical about the question.
Yeah.
He was asked about it and he said, why are you asking about that? I can't believe you're asking about that.
Just fans the flames.
Well, because that's what he used on the campaign trail, saying, I'm going to free the list of that and JFK.
Right.
And then he gets mad when he's asked about it. That didn't match.
Well, and they asked a legitimate question like, hey, can you just clear up, Pam Bondi, what you said about the client list is on my desk? And then can you confirm or deny this rumor that Jeffrey Epstein was an asset of an intelligence agency? Mm-hmm. And then Donald Trump jumps and she totally bypassed the intelligence question, which I'll get to in a moment. Mm-hmm. So all that. And then she clarified what she meant about the client list. Yeah. And then Donald Trump jumped down the guy's throat, which just fuels the flames of conspiracy.
Why wouldn't he just come out and say, hey, it was a lot of child porn that's in that.
Well, and she did say that. She said
she did, but I think he should have as well. He said, you know what? I did promise that on the campaign trail, but guess what? I didn't know how bad the stuff we had was.
Right. Well, and I think maybe that's part of it, is because Biden was hiding the client list, or people believed that he was, then it became this conspiracy. I don't even know if it's a conspiracy. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein did sick things. People did sick things with Jeffrey Epstein on his island, right? And these young girls. So that exists. So that's not conspiratorial at all. This is a real thing. We're not talking about like pizza kitchen levels of, conspiracy. But I think maybe there was a lot of people in MAGA and conservative circles who'd convince themselves that this client list existed. And so then, you know, Trump probably believed it too. And I don't know. I just don't know. But most of you think, yeah, the client list does exist. Michelle Maddox says flight logs is a client list, but only to a certain extent, because you can go to your buddy's island without raping an underage girl, you know? And I mean, even Bill Gates is not accused of, been on the plane, but it's just, I don't know, it's tough.
Oh, he was friends. He was legitimately friends with the guy. But yeah, and the missing minute and a half of video, that's the most suspicious to me. And I can't believe that they didn't think people would figure that out, this missing minute and a half. And then they're like, oh, but all the video has a missing minute and a half. It's just the clock resetting.
Because it's 11:59 p.m. and they say that the system resets. So it's this critical period of time where did somebody come into his cell?
But you weren't ready for that? I just think it's crazy.
Yeah. Let me read your comments on what's happening here. Chris says, Jeff Childers at the Substack Coffee and COVID did a great breakdown of this yesterday. I'll have to check that out. Let's see. Norm Wanderer, of course there's a client list, and I bet there's a lot of Dems on it. Look.
I bet there's a lot of everybody on
there's
it.
There's a lot of everybody on it. But at the same time, think about this. Let's say a client list exists. Who would both Joe Biden and Donald Trump be willing to protect? Who would it be besides, I think, two options? I only think there's two options. There's no client list. There's just kind of a spattering of names and stuff that they have no real evidence against. So either there's not an actual client list and that's true, they just handled it poorly, or he was an intelligence asset. Or that's one of the only things I can think of, is was he an intelligence asset and the U.S. government literally just cannot release that information? Because think of the can of worms that you would open up. And then if he's not an intelligence asset and there isn't a client list, then what is Ghislaine Maxwell doing in prison? You know, it's just like, it's crazy. So that's my conspiracy for today.
It's an interesting story. I don't think we'll ever really have the answer.
No, and we don't know.
Maybe like JFK.
We're just talking about it. Yeah, Joni, the info is being held back on purpose, embarrassing for high-profile people who are putting pressure on the administration. Shame on them. And it's from both sides right now. It's like, what do you mean there's no information on his clients? What do you mean? Danielle, no, likely there are big players around the world on that list. The world economy would be destroyed. I think it's bigger than they realized. So maybe they're like, oh, of course we'll release it. And then they saw it and they're like, oh, maybe we can't release that little guy right there. Who knows? Okay, I don't know. But a lot of you believe that there is a client list and that the Trump administration is lying about it. But then I see all these MAGA lunatics, and not all MAGA are lunatics, but there's like this faction of X that drives me nuts. And they're like, I'm done with Donald Trump. I'm not voting for Republicans in the midterms over this. It's like, really? You're going to vote for Democrats? Think of all
over
the...
So, this?
What is this? So it's like, over this, I get it, but it's still better than Democrats. And if the list exists, Biden still hit it too. So it's like, think of all the wonderful things Donald Trump is doing. And you have these people in the MAGA base who are so finicky, who'll be like, overnight, like, now you're dead to me. And it's like, okay, calm down. Nobody's expecting you to love everything he does. In fact, I think it's weird when anyone loves every single thing a politician does and is never critical of him. It's that party politics loyalty thing that I just think is weird. It's TDS type two.
It is.
TDS type two is when you just, Donald Trump can do no wrong. So I don't want that for anyone. But this idea that all these great things he's doing that need to be done, and Iran, I'm not voting for him again. Elon Musk, I'm starting a third party and we're going to primary Republicans. It's like, you guys chill out, you know, chill, take a breath, touch some grass, get off X.
It's not that I give him a pass, but sometimes I think it's like UFOs. Like, it's better as a conspiracy theory where it doesn't leave us in a panic, and I don't know.
I'm not panicked about UFOs.
But a lot of society would be. And so they just kind of let it hang, and you can believe it or don't believe it. And
I'm ready.
The world moves on in less chaos.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
Leave it where it is. There must be a good reason. I'm going to go with that.
Sure. Yeah, I guess. I don't even know. It's just like, it bothers me. It's like, oh, now I've abandoned everything. Okay, so you're going to get Democrats elected. What is that going to accomplish? I don't understand.
If it was really one name on the list, they could white it out.
Like, just get rid of that one name and they just add it over right without it.
I don't know why they didn't do that with the video time, but yep. You know, they
could, I think he was an intelligence asset. Right, but even if he was an intelligence asset, wouldn't he have said that to get out of going to prison? Wouldn't he have just come out and said, I was working for XYZ?
It would also be pretty. I mean, I don't think the guy was smart by any means, but
you don't think Jeffrey Epstein was smart?
No.
I think he was smart.
I mean, maybe, I mean, in a gross, disgusting way,
of
but
course.
Yeah, in an evil way, I guess. But also, do you think he just had this list that was just there for anybody to find to be like, here's all my clients who are breaking the law by having sex with minors? Like, no, I think that there's probably, like, they had to make their own list. They probably have a file and there's all these names in it and they were going to make a list and nobody made an actual list.
Well, and then, you know, Pam Bondi said there was so much of this was videos of child pornography. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not going to be released, but is this stuff off the internet? Is it stuff Epstein made at his island that has other people on it? Is this a done deal? Are you still, what is going on? So there's just, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Because if there is other people on it, then I hope you would be prosecuting.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I don't trust what's being said. I'll say that. I think there's more to it. There has to be. But also, am I going to abandon everything that's happening right now over this issue? No. But I do think Donald Trump could handle it better. We'll get to comments here on the what's happening opening statements today in the ballot observer case. Crafty Grandma Crispy says, are they able to contact the ballot counter as a witness? The old man who had no mask on? I mean, I suppose they could, but...
Yes, I was not wearing a mask.
I don't know. Maybe.
The officers?
Yeah. Well, I checked in with Tim Hazelow, and he said that one of the officers who was on the stand did say he wasn't wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. So the jury did get to hear it via that means. But I think it's more about the old man not being able to say, well, he wasn't wearing one either, which is just wild to me.
Mm-hmm.
R says, Tim's attorney needs to ask some creative questions that allow the witnesses to reveal that others weren't wearing masks as well. I'm sure they're trying to do that. On the NEA conference, Country Guy, I wasn't aware of the politics of any of my teachers. Yeah. Wasn't even thinking about politics in high school.
No.
Not even thinking about it. BJ Bumblebee, I think any teacher that encourages minor children in school to protest and break laws should lose their certification to teach.
Oh, they're teaching it in kindergarten in Seattle. Yeah. We were trying to get video of it, but they were taking kindergartners out and practice marching.
Yeah. And we couldn't confirm the story, so we didn't do it, although we kind of knew it. But we knew. Logan Casey, that's what these people do. They go on and on about fascists, and then they go commit an act, commit acts that are fascist by definition, like destroying people's personal property because they have differing opinions. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Everett Herald reporters asking for support. Todd Welch, I am the only right of center columnist in the Everett Herald. Yeah, I mean, and Todd, you know, you are, I would say, a centrist based on your comments. And it's very much with these newspapers, like the Seattle Times is like this. They won't print anything from a true and true conservative. Like, I'm not saying, Todd, you're not, but like anyone, like if you're a Trump supporter, God forbid that you have an article where you talk good about, they won't allow that. They can say something nice about Donald Trump. No, they'll have safe conservatives in that bubble, but then they'll publish things from loony lefties.
So that's the thing is that they're, so I know locally there's going to be a separation of some local media because they're saying, oh, this content is too right, so we're going to find a separate space for it and put it over here. And then they're going to leave everything else in the space that's considered news. Well, that's news on the left, but we're going to keep that as news and we're moving all this over to clearly
Everything
that is
that's
happening in
everything that's conservative has to be labeled conservative. And I don't have an issue with that per se, but whenever they write about me in the Times or any other thing, they say conservative or right wing podcaster. Okay. Do they ever, for a KUOW host, do they ever say liberal host? They never label anything liberal, left wing. They only have to add that sort of addendum, and I think that's because it's just assumed that, you know, a news host is liberal, maybe. But it's just wild. Mm-hmm. They tell on themselves with that, for sure. Caroline Balici, these news agencies regurgitate other wire reports. That's not journalism. These reporters don't report. They technically plagiarize.
Rephrase.
Yeah. Rephrase. Put that in AI. On the trans dude, okay, on the council member, it's just a line in here, trans dude. On the council member who was arrested for a second topless protest, AR says, absolutely disgusting. Yes, yeah. And I'd feel that way, really, no matter who felt like they needed to go out there and protest in the nude and make cops touch them nude. And all, it's just weird. And all those weird images of full nudity in public showers.
Yeah.
David Poland, if she wants to be treated as a woman, follow the laws of decency for women to not sexualize trans people, dress conservative, and behave at all times under the law with dignity. Nah, dignity isn't part of the equation with this one.
Attention.
On our interview with Democratic State Rep. Murray Levitt, Boltop says, this is a complete abdication of moral responsibility by the governor and the state. I agree. Greg O'Lake, as DCYF is an absolute failure to children in this state. They have no business recommending anything. And I agree, it's like DCYF thinks that PIC isn't good for kids. It's probably great for kids then, because yeah. DCYF has a pretty poor track record of protecting kids. Let's see. We got a couple other super chats. I'll get to Two Ladies Midwest Adventures. Did you know the Jamie Jones massacre was based on Marxist ideology gone overboard? I never learned that originally until we came across researching leftist groups. Jamie Jones, is that his name? Are you talking about the, maybe I'm thinking of someone else, like a cultist. Let's see. Also said, I know there's a lot going on, but I need to ask, where's a safe place for a tourist to stay in Seattle? That and a good place to eat reasonably. I'm not sure off the top of my head. I wouldn't really recommend a lot of places in Seattle. Definitely not in downtown. Let's see here. Grendel, keep up the good work, little lady. I will have your back if you ever run for governor. I'm open to volunteer at that point. Well, I appreciate that. I will put you on the maybe volunteer list. Nicole, would you volunteer for my campaign for governor?
Would I volunteer?
Well, oh, you want to get paid. Oh, okay. We'd still do the show.
Oh, okay.
There's nothing that says I'd have to stop the show. So then you would have to volunteer for the campaign.
Okay.
Nobody's going to be paid. It's like either your heart's in it or it's not.
Okay.
Yeah. And no organizing. None of my campaign staffers are going to be able to organize. You join a campaign union, fired instantly.
Oh,
instantly.
Yeah.
100%.
Even a whisper of it.
Even a whisper of unionizing. Done. Same here at Undivided. Somebody's going to report me to the state now. All right. Good comments per the usual. Sorry, we're going pretty late today. Let's get to our closing sanity check. This might be the best takedown I've ever seen of the liberal hypocrisy around the immigration issue. And as you guys know, moral consistency to me is a big thing. You know, being consistent, like either you support law enforcement or you don't. You know, either you are against political violence or you're not. Not picking and choosing based on who's doing what. So on The Five on Fox News, Jessica Tarlov, who's like kind of their token Democrat, I guess you'll recognize her, was totally being hypocritical of this immigration issue and what's happening right now. And Jesse Waters, I have never seen such a brilliant takedown in my life. Watch.
There was a story about a San Antonio area ICE detention center, a huge spike in 911 calls from people who have been detained there reporting increased suicide attempts and sexual abuse. Mm. What is going on with this immigration policy is not what people showed up on November 5th for. I know there are some folks out there, there are pictures of those grannies that had those signs that says mass deportation now.
What about you bring up something as charged as sexual abuse?
Yeah.
Who is causing the sexual abuse? Is it the people running the detention center are raping the detainees?
You've never heard of that happening or they're
so
abusing
them? Because I want to be clear that that's what you're alluding to.
That's what the report
So said. People that are running the detainee center are sexually abused.
I don't have video of what was happening. I just know that they are seeing an increased amount of 911 calls.
Jessica,
saying
Joe
that people
Biden
are
ran the largest sex trafficking operation in world history when
he let
12 million people pour in and then lost hundreds of thousands of kids. Okay, and all the polls you're setting were dead wrong on the election. That poll had Kamala beating Trump. Donald Trump was shot in the head. You guys firebomb cars. You riot. Now you're shooting at Border Patrol agents. And Dana is exactly right. This is the strategy. The base wants blood. And after January 6th, you guys hailed these people protecting the Capitol borders as heroes. But now the people protecting our borders are somehow Nazis. You call them Gestapo, Jessica, and then people take shots at them and you act like it's happening in a vacuum. Half of the ICE agents and Border Patrol people are Hispanic. You're basically calling Hispanic lawmen bad hombres and saying they're cowards for wearing masks. They're wearing masks because people are shooting at them.
Period. Period. Love it, Jesse Waters. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Remember, we cannot end our divisions until everyone is using their full brain and common sense. And that's really what this show is all about. If you'd like to support our show, why am I using a little British accent so much today? I don't know, maybe I was born to be British. But then, smart people fought against taxes. And here I am in America. What was I saying? Oh yeah, support our show for $5 a month. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. And just click on the banner that says support the show for $5 and we make it pretty easy. That's it. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.